We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Morning.
No Maria again this week. We'll probably be missing her through the end, well, not the end, the middle of April.
Yeah, it's her day job calls, and it's that time of year, so yep. We'll be missing her melodious voice, I suspect, for the next couple of weeks, which is a shame, but heck, it's more time for you and me alone in the studio. Nobody's listening, are they?
No, I don't think the microphones are on yet. let's plenty to cover this week, starting with local and our new governor coming out with a plan.
Yeah, it's a shame, and I'll talk about this in a minute. It's a shame we now have a reactionary run state Senate, because we now have a progressive governor, and unlike the last two Democratic governors, he has some political courage, which in this case is confused with common sense. Jay Inslee coming out this week with a proposal that would close over $500 million worth of corporate tax loopholes for the state as a way of addressing the state's $1.3 billion revenue shortfall in its budget this year for the biennial 2013-15 budget, as well as the quarter mandate that the legislature adequately fund K-12 education, something it should have been doing for many years. Inslee's proposal lists a number of specific corporate loopholes that he wants to target, and some of them truly are eye-opening in terms of being a measure of just how warped our legislative priorities have gotten when we are, you know, jacking up tuition rates, denying education to kids, denying basic social services, literally letting people die because they fall through the safety net in order to fund some of these things instead. We have, for example, Inslee wants to target $83 million a year in sales tax breaks for landline telephones, which is a surprise both that tax break exists and that there are literally enough landline telephones still being sold that you could have $83 million a year in tax breaks. But that one's on the list. A $51 million break on bottled water sales, $40 million a year in subsidies for oil companies, which will come as a shock to oil companies who desperately need that help in order to stay in business. We have a $55 million break on farm auction purchases. The list goes on and on and on. The proposal, however, was immediately dismissed out of hand by the Republicans who control the state Senate, and in particular the Republican chair of the Senate Budget Committee, immediately after Inslee's announcement, had a press conference of his own at which he announced that there would be no new revenue increases even considered by the Senate Budget Committee this year or included in the budget that they produce. Even though you have a Democrat in the governor's mansion now who, unlike Christine Gregoire before him and Gary Locke before her, is not a corporate centrist and is willing to consider having the wealthy pay their fair share in this state, even though you have him in place now, you have, of course, Gregoire and Locke failed to take on the two-thirds revenue increase requirement that Tim Eymann's initiatives had imposed, even though it was pretty plainly unconstitutional, and it took a number of years before that finally made its way to the state Supreme Court and was overturned earlier this year. So that's out the window for the state legislature this year. They no longer need a two-thirds vote in order to enact such increases. But you can't do it when such a budget can't even get a hearing in one of the two chambers of the legislature. So Democrats could have challenged that law a number of years earlier. They had the majorities in both houses of the state legislature for 25 years or so, in which they could have gotten something like this passed. And when they had the opportunity, they couldn't do it. And now that they have a leader who actually has the common sense to propose something like this. The examples that he cited are so ridiculous and so marginally useful to the state economy that you have to wonder how many more of them are buried in the state budget like that. I'm sure there are a lot. You would have to hope that in future years, there will be the political will in the legislature to go along with those other factors, and that we'll be able to get it passed. But it doesn't look like it'll be able to happen this year.
So the governor's plan, is it just symbolic then with the way that the Senate is?
Yes and no. It won't get passed in that in that version. However, some version of it could get passed in the House, and then the way that the budget is enacted is the House and the Senate have to come up with a compromise bill. And you know, so it's a negotiating ploy. It's a negotiating ploy to try and get some of those things potentially enacted in a final compromise bill that the Senate and the House can agree on. But it almost certainly, and then it goes back to both the Senate and the House for final approval. And the real question is whether the Republicans in the Senate could block any tax increases that the two houses compromise on, even if the leadership of the Republican minority that controls the Senate has signed off on it, whether the rank and file Republicans who control the different committees and whatnot would go along with it. So it's very likely that there's going to be multiple special sessions this year to try and get a budget passed between the budget, the revenue shortfall, and the court-ordered mandate for funding K-12 education. They've got to come up with a lot of money, and the budget has already been stripped well beyond its bare bones over the past several years. So it's not going to be easy, and something like this really does need to be on the table. The opposition to it at this point from the Republican side is pretty purely ideological and not based in the simple reality of mathematics. So hopefully that mathematics will force the issue to at least some degree, but it's hard to tell. But no, it's not simply symbolic.
Well, and part of the problem appears to be from redefining closing a tax loophole as a tax increase.
Yes.
So
yeah, you've got, you know, the ideological opposition to any kind of funding increases on any line item at all by a lot of the Republicans, you know, simply doesn't match the complexity of how a very large institution like state government works, where a budget is in constant flux all the time, and some things' revenues go down and others' revenues go up. You know, it's how you would manage any large enterprise, but you can't manage it well when you're that ideologically rigid.
All right. Moving on, sticking with local, South Lake Union.
Yeah, we talked last week about this, the City Council's South Lake Union Committee, which actually is an ad hoc committee that actually has all 9 council members on it, met this last Monday to consider 4 competing proposals for what to do about all the different amenities and side issues that were not considered earlier this month when the Senate passed Paul Allen's massive new upzoning for South Lake Union that will allow 40-story towers now in what was once a fairly quiet residential neighborhood. The big bone of contention is something called the Incentive Zoning Program, which is the program the city has set up to try and offset from these upzoning developments, the loss of affordable housing. And the idea is that that developers are required to make some portion of their new developments, actually affordable housing units. And the incentive zoning program, however, is much weaker than it is in a number of other cities. Here it's an optional thing because developers can opt out and then pay into a city fund rather than building the affordable housing themselves, pay into a city fund, which is then supposed to provide that affordable housing. And the city has historically set the rates so low for paying into that fund that developers almost always choose that option. And the money that is raised that way is nowhere near adequate. Actually, when the program was originally started, it was nowhere near adequate to provide a replacement level affordable housing. And then it hasn't been adjusted for inflation over the time, so it's fallen even farther behind. The Mayor McGinn's proposal for South Lake Union continues that fine trend. His proposal is for about $15.15 per net square foot, for the money going into the affordable housing fund, which would really pay for only a fraction of the units that are needed to offset or to meet the demand and offset what's being built at South Lake Union with its huge increase in density. And there were 4 proposals before the committee. They were set to decide on one of them this week, and then that would be voted on by the same 9 people as acting in this case as the full city council for final approval this coming Monday. in 2 days. They did not decide this past Monday. It was a packed hearing. There were four different proposals, as I said, from Tim Burgess, Sally Clark, Michael Bryan, and Nick Licata. Three of those proposals did go back and adjust the incentive zoning in lieu of fees for past inflation, unlike what the mayor and Richard Conlon want to do, which is not even do that. And two of them, I believe O'Brien and Burgess, also chained it. In terms of future increases to the consumer price index, so it would be allow for inflation in the future. The fourth proposal was from Nick Licata, and that one was much better. It did a couple things. Number one, it raised the in lieu of fees dramatically, rather than the 50% or so that the other three did, where it goes from $15 a square foot to somewhere around, $20 to $23, depending on the proposal. Nick's would have taken it up to $120 per square foot, which is more what is actually needed in order to replace the affordable housing that is lost. The other thing that Licata's proposal would do is, rather than the range of 80 to 100 percent of average median income being defined as affordable for housing, which, to put it into context, for a family of four, that's an income of up to $64,000 a year, which hardly qualifies as poor in Seattle, although it probably feels like some of the people in that. But there's, you know, the people who lived in the old Cascade neighborhood that's been torn down to make way for all this lived on a whole lot less than $64,000 a year in most cases. So Nick's instead would have required that half of those units be in the 60 to 80% of AMI income range, which is also desperately needed and is actually quite a bit less than that income range. So that got a lot of support from the people who were attending. And what wound up happening is that the committee did not make a decision this past Monday. They postponed the decision until April 15th, which is 2 weeks from Monday. And given that you have three council members proposing more conservative proposals, and you have at least one council member, Richard Conlon, on the record as saying, well, we shouldn't put any more money into it, and besides, those icky poor people should all be living down in the South End anyway, and we shouldn't let them up into the nice neighborhoods. You know, chances are very good that it will be some compromise of those proposals. That'll be what the council winds up adapting. But the fact that there was so much support for Licata's proposal is encouraging. It meant they delayed a final decision this past week. And I would encourage people over the next couple of weeks to continue contacting council members and expressing support for Nick Licata's proposal and for putting enough money into the incentive zoning program to actually provide a meaningful amount of affordable housing to offset what's being put into Lake Union, South Lake Union.
Hmm. All right.
Oh, and then the committee decision, which will be the real key decision since it'll put on all nine council members on the record, is April 15th. But the actual final vote of the council now is not scheduled until May 6th. So there's still some time.
All right, for people to weigh in. All right, let's move on to national, and it was appeared to be a pretty busy week for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, this week's Supreme Court spending a couple days hearing arguments on the case challenging the constitutionality of both the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8. A lot of commentators from the left and otherwise have been pretty gleeful at the oral arguments and the line of questioning that was done. In particular, you had Elena Kagan just skewering the conservative lawyer who was trying to defend Prop 8 by arguing that the state has a vested interest in only allowing couples who can procreate to marry, since that actually is not the reality of a lot, if not maybe even a majority of marriages in the land at this point, between age and medical issues and birth control and all the other reasons people don't or can't have kids. So you had also Justice Anthony Kelly, who's widely thought to be the swing vote on this case between the four reactionary justices who will vote against anything that that liberalizes anything, and the four more liberal votes. Kennedy also has some libertarian streaks, and he had some very hostile questions for the lawyers defending the anti-gay laws. But a couple of cautions on this. One is that it's notoriously difficult, even for experts, to predict how a Supreme Court case will come down. Even though a lot of these justices do seem to be fairly predictable, it's, there's really no telling, and this is likely to be a close ruling either way, so it could just be one or two fickle votes that decide literally the fate of the civil rights of millions of people. The other thing about this is that the Supreme Court could always choose to rule very narrowly on these laws without actually necessarily providing any relief to the people who are discriminated against because of them. So, we'll find out when they rule in June. And we may not find out before then. I would caution against reading too much into the oral arguments this week.
All right. John Brennan.
Brennan, yes. Career war criminal. Oversaw many of the worst excesses of the torture program under Bush-Cheney. And now President Obama's newly appointed head of the CIA. And surprise, surprise, when you elect a war criminal to run your clandestine agency, he winds up surrounding himself with other war criminals. His first controversy, literally weeks into his new tenure, comes around the proposed appointment to replace a vacancy in heading the clandestine operations department of the CIA. They obviously don't publicly identify who the person running that department is, but the person who is the interim head of that department and is up for a permanent appointment is a woman who apparently, along with Jose Rodriguez, was instrumental in overseeing and ordering the destruction of the torture tapes in Thailand that the Department of Justice has a couple of times on different occasions investigated and then declined to prosecute, even though it was clearly destruction of evidence and went against both the DOJ's instructions, their own lawyers' instructions, and the will of Congress. Brennan has to decide whether to appoint this woman, even though she, pretty clearly grossly violated both international law and human rights and the actual law, not just by torturing people, but then destroying the evidence about that. So he has taken the unusual step of convening a panel of former top CIA officials to evaluate the candidates for the positions, and who he has chosen to evaluate, whether this woman has the, in the Immortal Alice's restaurant words, whether this person is moral enough to, bomb villages, burn women, rape women and children and all the rest of it. It's pretty interesting to see who he's chosen. One of them is a guy named, John McLaughlin, who is a former interim director of the CIA before Porter Goss came in. So that was in 2003, 2004, just as the torture program was heating up after the invasion and beginning of the occupation of Iraq. We have a woman named Mary Margaret Graham, who also is a veteran of the same era in the CIA, before moving over to work with yet another war criminal, John Negroponte, at the then newly created Department of International Intelligence, and a guy named Stephen Capps, who among other things, was one of the 23 Americans convicted in absentia by an Italian court with the extraordinary rendition, kidnapping, and torture of an Islamic cleric off the streets of Milan in 2003. He also has been credibly accused of covering up the death of a prisoner in Afghanistan, and a number of other things that are linked to in the program notes that we have up for this at eatthestate.org. Those are the people that Brennan has chosen out of just about everybody in the world to diffuse ethical questions about a CIA's leader's past. And it says a lot about who Brennan knows, who he surrounds himself with, and who we're likely to get running the CIA under his tenure. It's a very discouraging development. Mm.
All right. Well, speaking of discouraging developments, talk about what happened with the Senate this week.
Yeah, a couple bad things in the Senate this week. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid dropping from the gun reform law the Senate is now considering, both the provision banning high-capacity magazines and the assault weapons ban. Remember, the assault weapons ban was the law of the land until only a few years ago. Now Reid says he could probably get no more than 40 votes for such a bill in the Senate. That means that if you think every Republican would vote against it, it means at least 16 Democrats would as well. Even in the wake of Newtown, you have the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers lobby and the NRA, which are basically the same thing, have that much control over, over Congress. It's very discouraging to see. The Senate also, late last week, put through a resolution, supporting the construction of the XL pipeline. Now this is pretty much, ceremonial, because again, it's the Secretary of State, John Kerry, and his department that will make the final decision on the XL. Of course, Kerry's wife, who is, a ketchup heiress and very wealthy, has extensive energy holdings. So, in a perfect world, he would recuse himself from that decision, but he probably won't. The Senate vote was instructive. It was 62 to 37 in favor of building the XL pipeline, except that again, it shows, just how badly the energy industry has compromised our government's ability to deal with climate change, because you have a list. And again, on the program notes up on the website, we have the list of Democrats who voted in favor of this. Almost all of them are from states that have oil interests or coal interests or fracking or some combination of the three. And they've literally bought off enough of our decision makers that we can't do anything about climate change. It's very discouraging.
All right. Virginia.
Yeah. Outgoing Virginia governor and probable GOP presidential candidate in 2016, Bob McConnell, he of the Forced Vaginal Ultrasounds, signed into law this week a harsh new voter ID bill that would require a state-issued voter ID for anybody casting a ballot every time they do so. That, again, expected to disenfranchise a large number of people, mostly non-white students, the elderly and such, all of whom tend to vote Democratic, which, of course, is the whole point of the bill. So, you know, once again, you've got a case where even with all of the punditry about how Republicans are going to try and moderate and appeal more to non-whites and so forth, on the ground, that's not happening. At the state level, where the next generation of federal lawmakers is going to come from, it's not happening. You have an entire generation of Tea Party Republicans who really believe in this stuff and really are that bigoted and really are that radical. And they're not going to change just because some polling tells them to. The crazy is going to be with us for some time to come. And it reared its ugly head again this week in Virginia.
A new study out regarding new media?
Yeah. The International Center for the Study of Radicalization came out with a study this week describing what happened when researchers sought to map the study of social media, in this case Twitter, by white nationalists in the United States, trying to figure out where it is that organized racists get their information with, what they share with, or misinformation, what they share with each other, you know, where all this stuff comes from. And what they found, much to their surprise, is that it's not, you know, sort of radical far-right websites and periodicals like Stormfront that these people are passing around. They're passing around mainstream conservative media, things like Breitbart.com, Daily Caller, you know, tapes from the Rush Limbaugh Show and talk radio, Fox News, things like that. It's not that these media outlets are being run by white racists. It's that white racists are getting inspired by the content there. It's kind of fascinating to see, and it raises the kind of obvious question of why these kind of links aren't studied more in more academic circles, probably because it uncovers some uncomfortable links and cross-pollination between those two camps, which do have some significant overlap, I think.
Well, and with the recent news of the FBI wanting real-time analysis of social media by 2013, I guess they could do the analysis for us.
Well, yeah, since they're on so many of the same.
Of course, we won't get any of the reports, but
yeah.
Let's move on to international and cyber attacks.
Yeah, a terrible front page above the fourth story in the New York Times yesterday. Co-authored by their star national reporter David Sanger, who is responsible for a lot of the misinformation in the run-up to the Iraq War 10 years ago. It's amazing how many of these people who were spectacularly wrong 10 years ago are still in positions of prestige and influence today and paid zero price for all of the lives that they cost with their propaganda. So they had this front page story yesterday, and the headline of it really tells you where it's coming from. Cyber attacks seem meant to destroy, not just disrupt. And it was all about how there have been some hacking attempts on some big bank and financial institutions, websites, American Express, etc. And you have the article blaming North Korea and Iran for these attacks, even though there is zero evidence to that. And the actual article cites no evidence about it. They quote one so-called, you know, industry investigator who turns out to be a long-term right-wing hawk and an unnamed government official. And that's it. When you have literally tens of millions of people in this country, hundreds of millions of people around the world whose lives have been destroyed by the greed and criminality of these big banks, many of those people, I guarantee, have some IT chops. And, you know, they have a lot more motive to go after somebody like Bank of America than say, North Korea does. Again, this is an effort to blame countries like that. Implicitly, all the evidence you need is they're evil, therefore they must be doing it. That's literally the level at which the front page of the, you know, premier news, establishment newspaper in this country, where it is coming from with a story like this. It's very, very frightening because, you know, the takeaway from something like this is, well, they need to be attacked. And what one of the things the article does not mention, of course, is that the U.S. has already been launching cyber attacks, particularly against Iran, and has been doing so since at least the middle of last decade, as we've talked about on this show, with an early version of Stuxnet. You know, we've been launching aggressive, illegal attacks on them, not the other way around, but you would never know it from this kind of media coverage.
And they didn't hide that behind the paywall, huh?
No, that one was free to everybody, yeah.
All right. Wanted to get to it last week, but didn't have time. Syria.
Yeah, another example of right-wing warmongering, masquerading as so-called legitimate news coverage are the reports have been circulating for a couple weeks now around reports that the Syrian government used chemical weapons in a missile attack in the town of Khan al-Asal that reportedly killed 31 people and wounded more than 100. The problem is that the allegations simply aren't true, or at least as some other investigative journalists and regional experts have pointed out, there's no known evidence that is true, and plenty of reason to think that if any chemical agent was used in that attack, it was a non-lethal irritant used in crowd control, you know, kind of like the ones that were used here during WTO, which is a form of chemical warfare, but seems to be quite fine and ducky when cops here use it. The better question is, though, that rather than did they use chemical weapons, is why you've got those kind of unproven and unlikely allegations getting traction in U.S. media. I mean, it's so unlikely that Assad, the Syrian leader, actually asked the U.N. to investigate the charges, something he certainly would not have done had the charges actually been true and he actually used that as weapons. But here you have politicians like Mike Rogers, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Carl Levin, who's chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain, who's never met a war he didn't like. They've all jumped on these reports in order to call for the U.S. military to intervene in the Syrian civil war in the last couple of weeks. It's also worth noting that those allegations emerged last week just before Barack Obama went to Israel, you know, and so we're kind of conveniently timed to call for more military action in the Middle East, something that Israel no doubt would very much like to do. You know, you have to ask where some of these reports are coming from, and with all, you know, all mainstream media reports of this kind, you have to look at it very skeptically and look at what evidence actually is there and what actually is not being said.
All right. Events.
Yeah, coming up later today, the anniversary in 1976 of occupation of Palestine, a significant day. There's international actions happening today, and including today an action, international actions by the BDS movement. Today there will be a march and rally starting at Westlake at 1 o'clock, going from 1 to 3 o'clock, co-sponsored by the Northwest BDS Coalition, the Palestine Solidarity Committee, Voices of Palestine, and a number of others. And again, that's 1 o'clock today at Westlake Park. Should be a beautiful, glorious day. Lots of shoppers. Go down and remind them where our tax dollars are going in this tax season. Westlake Park, 4th and Pine.
Talking with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And once again this week, we have notes up from all the stories you heard today with links and sources and all that kind of good stuff. So check it out.